Welcome to the very first episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And what a better way to start this entire series that you're about to hear with the director of Captain America, the First Avenger, as we will be mentioning at the beginning of every show, director Joe Johnston, who's joining us on our third Joe Johnston-directed feature. Joe, thanks for being a part of the show.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
that's good. Hope so. Fingers crossed. So anyway, Hal, you were going to be introducing a bunch of these things. So why don't you give us a synopsis of the first minute of Captain America, the First Avenger?
All right. And thankfully, there's no dialogue in here, so I don't have to embarrass myself in front of Mr. Director. Mm-hmm. All right. The synopsis for minute one, a night sky above a cloud deck, 23 animated star shapes encircle a mountain. The word Paramount appears in front of the mountain. Underneath the word Paramount, a title states, a Viacom company. Scene fades to a series of comic book pages flipping atop each other rapidly. Giant letters resolve into the word Marvel. Beneath the Marvel brand, the word Studios appears. Fade to gray, a murky, dark day in the Arctic. Two sets of blinding headlights from several snowcats appear. And that's minute one.
Wow.
Wow. Does sound familiar, I have to say.
I actually had a question about this minute of the movie. I was struck watching it by how the Paramount and Marvel logos were totally silent. And to me, that suggested the dead silence of being in suspended animation for 70 years. Was that your call? Did you do that?
You know, that's a great idea. I wish it had been mine. I don't recall that there was a reason for that silence, actually.
Usually there's at least the big bombastic Marvel theme, the dun, 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 you know, yeah. And it was just eerily silent.
Huh. Well, you know, it's been almost 16 years, so.
You should take the credit for it.
I will. Okay, it was my idea. Yeah, and it's a great one, too. It's a fantastic idea.
It kind of falls in with the other ones. I mean, when we looked at October Sky, you were doing the radio intro, and I guess Rocketeer had that very beautiful piano. So we're getting into unusual openings without you and music over you and the standard stock foot. Although Paramount doesn't really have a fanfare, fanfare doesn't really show up in many of your films. Mm. Let's go back where you're at in this part of your filming career. You just come off of Wolfman. And
no, I hadn't come off Wolfman.
Oh, okay.
That's the problem. When I accepted the Wolfman gig, which, as you may have heard, was, you know, I took over the production from another director with about 3 weeks of prep. But I, you know, almost as soon as I said, I'll do the Wolfman picture, I got a call from Kevin Feige asking me if I'd like to direct, Captain America. So I had barely started the Wolfman project when I knew I was going to do Captain America. It's all about timing. Everything is about timing. Had I waited a couple of days, it would have all been different. But, a lot went on while I was shooting Wolfman and doing post in Wolfman. You know, for one thing, the writers were writing the script. They hadn't written it yet. So that took several months. But it was a sort of an interesting situation. You know, I don't like being one of those fix it guys who gets called when a production is in trouble and the director gets fired or drops out or something. But I've had that experience more than once. And you know, it was, sometimes there are a lot of reasons why we work, One of them is we need to get paid now and then. And so that's what the Wolfman job was about originally. And well, it's a long, sad story, but we won't go into that. You can do that for the Wolfman minute.
We go.
And please don't have one.
Yeah, no, it's we'll table that one. But I was just wondering, in on when we were talking with on October Sky, you had been involved with Incredible Hulk. They were feeling you out for doing Incredible Hulk. Was this a carryover, or did they have you penciled in the background doing another Marvel movie later on since you didn't pick up on that, or?
No, I guess the I had told Mark Platt, who was running Universal or co-running Universal at the time, that I wasn't going to do the Hulk. I was going to help Jonathan Hensley develop the screenplay, but he was unconvinced, and he said, "Oh, when you get the screenplay working great, you're going to want to direct it." I said, "No, I'm not going to direct it. I'm telling you got to find somebody else. I'm helping Jonathan develop it." And midway through that process, Chuck Gordon got in touch with me and sent me the script for October Sky, which was at the time called Rocket Boys, as we know. And so I dropped out of Hulk immediately as soon as I read Rocket Boys. And I forget what happened. Jonathan Hensley did not end up directing it, although I suggested that he should move into the writer director position. I don't know what happened on that, but I was long gone by then.
Interesting. Joe, what was the state of the Captain America script when you got the call? Had that been written, or how far along was it?
No, there was a story. There was the original story took place half in 1940 or 1941 and half in the present day. And I didn't think that was a very good idea because you sort of get one chance to tell the origin story of something.
Right.
And Kevin Feige agreed with me on that. So we had our confrontations with Marvel, which at the time was a comic book company, and the guy that ran the comic book company was sort of in charge and everything, but and he wanted it to be split half and half, and we didn't. And it came to the point where I was going to say, "Well, I'm not really interested in doing it unless we can tell the origin story." And so we eventually wore them down, and they agreed to do the work, the origin story with a couple of bookends, present day bookends.
So our audience is going to hear me mention this more than once, but throughout some of these episodes, but one of the personally favorite things about the movie is the fact that we got an entire World War II movie with, with the present day epilogue. I, going into it, I would have been disappointed. I think if it had been the other way around, if this is World War II is a little bit of a prologue and then the whole rest of it's present day, or I'd never heard that idea that it might have been split 50-50, but we needed that full lush experience, the period piece, and there was nobody better than you to direct that part of it, or to direct it because of that reason.
I agree that it really needed to be the origin, the 1940 origin story, because you, like I said, you only get one chance to tell that story. And it's not like you could do the other version and then go back and then and say, "Now let's what was the origin story? Let's tell that now." You can't do that. You can't go backwards like that.
Joe, was this your first EP credit that you were executive producing on a feature film?
I guess it was, yeah. I didn't ask for
Oh.
Well, that was a nice thing to find under the tree. I was just wondering if it helped in any way in your not only in your direction but in the scope of traveling with the movie of getting it in your vision if it helped.
Oh.
It's just a thing. Okay.
And movies are a director's format, and TV is the producer's format. So I with Marvel's help and Kevin Feige's help especially, I got to make the movie that I wanted to make. We agreed pretty much on what the movie should be.
Since we're talking about, the timeline of this thing, I was wondering if you had any thoughts then or now about the narrative timeline. For example, when Captain America was originally defrosted in the comics, it was 1964. It had only been 20 years since he went into the ice. He comes out. Nick Fury's still alive. He's older, but Nick Fury was the head of the Howling Commandos in World War II. Peggy Carter's still alive, and she's a middle-aged woman, but she's alive. And if you make that time span more like 70 years, like you had to now, I think it makes everyone Steve Rogers knew is dead, and it makes that story so much sadder and an entirely different story than was told in the comic books. I don't, there's nothing else you could have done than to set it in modern day, but did you give any thought to what that would mean for the character to be in suspended animation for 70 years versus 20 years or that kind of thing?
Well, not really, because we had no choice. We couldn't have him wake up in some other some other time,
Yeah, he.
and then try to jump ahead. It just wouldn't work. But that was not really ever discussed.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was wondering, you do have some of your crew that, people that are always going with you. This is the final film that you made, I think, with Robert Dalva as the editor. I was wondering who else you were bringing in from previous working together. Who else was working on this with you?
Richard Whelan worked with me on this one. He was my UK first AD, who I first met on Wolfman, and he's a fantastic first assistant director, which he's not a job he's not doing anymore. He's producing now, but I brought him in. I brought let's see, I have to, well, Shelley Johnson, of course,
Right.
to shoot it. Shelley is I think of him as my secret weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's fantastic. But Robert, Shelley, Richard Whelan, who else was there? Well, there for one, there was if you go above the line, there was Hugo Weaving,
Right.
of course, as Red Skull. Who was also in Wolfman. So yeah, I like working with people that I've had a good experience with in the past. Yeah.
When casting was going along, did Marvel have prearranged ideas, and did they have a cast for you of any of them, or was it wide open for you?
No, there was no cast. Nothing had been either dictated or chosen before I came on board. There was an actress that they wanted to play the Peggy Carter role, but we did a screen test, and she was obviously not as commanding as
Haley
Haley.
Atwell.
Haley.
That well.
We're all a little obsessed and ashamed to admit it, but there it is.
Well, she hasn't said no yet to
She
being on
hasn't
the
said
show,
no
so
to being on
we're
the
waiting.
podcast.
Her agent hasn't said no, so fingers crossed on that.
But I
The
think it's universally agreed that you just knocked the casting on this movie out of the park, from Chris Evans to Haley Atwell to, Tommy Lee Jones, Stanley Tucci, Hugo Weaving. It's just flawless. Do you feel like you got lucky? Do you feel like you're just that good?
No, I think we got lucky in a couple of places. We had to really convince Chris Evans. He didn't want to do it because of his experience, on Fantastic Four a long time ago. But we wore him down, and I think they made him a great deal. And we also invited him in to look at all the art in the art department, all the illustrations on the walls, which he. Hopefully, we sort of blew him away with all that stuff, and he agreed to do it. But yeah, Chris was the right choice in a lot of for a lot of reasons.
As the kids say, I think he understood the assignment.
Yeah, I
He
think
knew
he
how to do
did.
that right.
He certainly did.
Absolutely. Did you have anybody else in mind ever for the Tommy Lee Jones character? Because that just seems like it's tailor-made for him, and the kind of thing you want Tommy Lee Jones, you plug him in and he does exactly that.
Right. I didn't. Tommy Lee Jones was a bit of a surprise for me. I think Kevin came to me and he one day, and I don't know where we were in the casting process, but he said, "Hey, how about Tommy Lee Jones?" And I was sort of, "Whoa, that's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about that." Yeah, okay, fine with me. Which is how a lot of that stuff happens sometimes. He makes a phone call and he talks to somebody's agent and they, send him a script and yeah, this is good. So, but that was a bit of a surprise. I wasn't, nobody asked me first who I thought the perfect character would be, a perfect actor would be for that character. And they came to me and said, "Hey, how about Tommy Jones?" Yeah, okay,
Yeah, I was thinking that
fine.
Chris Cooper is probably looking at his phone all the time. Wait, let me see. Maybe that'll be me. But no, yeah, Tommy Lee was perfect in the role.
He was great.
The other question you probably get asked way too many times is how far ahead was Marvel pushing you on things that you had to set up for future films, or was that, I mean, like the Tesseract and things that's going to be coming up? I don't know how far they were thinking toward Infinity War.
That's a good question. It was, I think stuff like that is probably is up to Kevin Feige and his crew, because nobody knows the Marvel Universe better than Kevin. And I was not sort of party to any of those discussions about where things were going to go in later features. So,
Yeah, okay.
I had a lot of stuff to concentrate on with just the first Avenger.
Yeah, this was, I mean, this was really compared with some of the other, I mean, you did, Jurassic Park 3 and things like that, but just looking at the number of people involved in this particular film, that was kind of like your Everest in terms of how big a production it was, I think. Was it, do you feel like this was the biggest movie you've ever worked on?
It probably was. And again, I've said this before in other interviews, but Kevin Feige and his team, there were a couple of scenes where we shot what was on the page and we cut it together and we cut it into what existing footage we had. And we decided, universally across the board that, this, it's not big enough. The scene that we shot and that was written and we now have is not enough. So Kevin was, in a couple of cases, he went back to the powers that be at the time, which was still, Marvel, the comic book company, and he got us some more money. We reshot it, and the foremost example of that would be the fight on the train where Bucky, dies. It just the first version of that was just not, it wasn't big enough. It didn't do justice to Bucky's character. And we went back, we got more money, we got a bigger set and more visual effects. We shot it again, and I think it turned out great.
Oh, agreed. Yes.
Yeah, hear, hear.
One other thing we haven't talked, well, we hopefully will be having on a future episode, we're going to be having Alan Silvestri on, and we had talked, I'm going to be referring to the October Sky minute for a lot. We had talked with Mark Isham at the about making the music. When Robert was laying down, one of the things that Robert had said in previous interviews was that he always liked to lay down a lot of music first and cut against the music. Do you remember what he was using as a soundtrack for the temp? Was he using other Alan Silvestri music or?
I don't remember if it was or not. I mean, I you there's this thing called temp love that you listen to the movie so many times with temp music, and then your composer composes some fantastic score, and you sit there wishing it was more like the temp. So I to avoid that, I like to forget the temp, and sometimes I even like to watch the movie without music, just to see if everything else is working okay. But I don't remember if he did or not. And Robert was one of the editors. He actually wasn't the main editor. It was Jeff Ford was the main editor. editor on that. He probably would have been involved with the music at that point, with temp music. So, but I don't remember if we, had anything that, I don't know where it came from. It was, action movie music,
Yeah.
I would love to dig a little bit into cinematography, if you wouldn't mind, especially the cinematography of doing these period pieces, because it seems like it's not just as simple as throwing a sepia tone filter over the lens. You and your team are making smart choices about color palettes, about saturation and soundscape, and a lot of details transport us to this time and space. And it struck me that Captain America looks different from The Rocketeer, which looks different from October Sky, but they're all these period pieces. Do you have any thoughts or philosophy or approach to getting that right?
Well, you keep in mind that three different cinematographers shot those movies, and the I like to basically hand over that stuff to a cinematographer once we agreed what the movie's going to look like. I wanted The Rocketeer to look like a hand-tinted postcard, and I've said that in interviews before too. And I think that Hiro Narita did a fantastic job of creating that effect. Fred Murphy, who shot October Sky, I think even though he hated it and most of it hated it, the weather was his best friend because it gave him all kinds of opportunities to exploit the weather and make it feel like you were, in West Virginia in 1957. I thought he did a fantastic job of that, but it was, it was grueling. Because we had every possible kind of weather you could think of. With Captain America, I sat down with Shelley and we sort of talked about a color palette for a lot of it, where it was, with Steve Rogers, it was sort of warm and American and inviting, and with Hydra and Red Skull, it was colder and, darker. And then I just turned him loose and said, do your thing, which is where guys like Shelley, do their best work when you just let them, set them free, let them do what their instincts tell them is right. So, yeah, it's different every time is basically what I'm saying.
It's striking to me what a difference there is between, the World War II version of Captain America's world, and then when he runs into Times Square at the end, and it's modern day Times Square. It looks different, it sounds different, it's bright and blaring, and it's just a fun contrast, really neat contrast to the past.
Yeah, I was hoping we'd get a sunny day in Times Square. We didn't.
But you were actually in Times Square.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we were in right in Times Square. But we made it work. You can do a lot of stuff in post to make it brighter and warmer and more interesting looking, but we had an overcast day.
One of the I something that keeps coming up, well, it comes up on the DVD and things like that, is the amount of time that had to be spent on of naturally of on set design and costuming. There was a lot of work, especially on costuming, with Ryan Meinerding. He was had been working on the artwork. How many versions of the Captain America? I mean, there were different versions of what he was wearing, but how many iterations? And I was thinking that reminded me of like the iterations going on with the Rocketeer. Did you feel deja vu with that?
Well, with the Rocketeer, it was his costume was determined by Dave Stevens, and we did not vary at all from that. We basically gave the costume designer the comic books and or the graphic novels and said, copy this. We didn't change anything. I mean, the helmet was a bit of a challenge to get exactly right, but we had Dave Stevens come in and work on the d design with the sculptor. The Captain America, his various the versions of his outfit went through sort of a lot of different trials, but the lady who came in to sort of save the day, Anna. You probably know her name.
Anna Shepherd, yeah.
Anna Shepherd came in and did a fantastic job and just basically turned the costume department around, where we were sort of struggling at first. And she turned it around and whipped everybody into shape and came up with these great costumes, you know, both versions. His show tune outfit, which I think is great. I love that one. And then his final, you know, the battle, his Stark, Howard Stark outfit, you know. But yeah, she did a fantastic job.
I am not. I was trying to figure it out from all your past ones. This is your first musical, I think. Was this your first filmed musical that you had?
The sequence, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. One of my favorite parts of the whole movie. You know, it was really fun to shoot. The girls had gone off and rehearsed this march for weeks, you know, where they were trying not to run into each other. When they did the Destruction Derby march, but it worked out so great. It was so much fun to shoot.
It was so evocative too. It was so instantly believable that that's exactly what would have been going on at a big USO show things.
Yeah, and just to give people a sneak preview, we will be having Hitler on the show later on. The stage,
Oh, great.
he has some very interesting stories about his time on stage.
Remind me what his name is again.
James Payton.
Peyton.
James Peyton, right.
James Payton, yeah, and he has a great documentary out there about being basically a day worker, what it's like being a day worker actor. And he was not only in Captain America, he was also in
One of the Harry
one of
Potters.
the Harry Potter series. And he goes to children's schools around the UK and talks about being in movies and talks about Harry Potter and reading and things like that. So he
That's
has a little
great.
cottage industry out of that little part that he has coming up
Good
on our show.
for him. That's great.
Now, as we were talking about earlier, this is a pretty big production. I was wondering, as a director, you're there directing scenes, but you've got, first unit and second unit going on. You've got your AD, and you've got a whole second unit doing the other shots. Did this movie have a lot more delegation for you than actual just sitting saying action and cut?
Not so much. I don't have a problem with delegating work to others, you know, other qualified people when I need to. But Shelley, he doesn't he really resists shooting a lot of second unit, and he also resists shooting with more than one camera. We very seldom would have a second camera on anything. It just means you have to work a lot faster and, you know, get as many setups as you would. I mean, unless it's a stunt or a visual effects sequence, then you've got as many cameras as you can afford on there. But for shooting the main parts of the movie, he felt like the second camera always compromises the first. So I forget what the question was now, but
You're only using one camera rather than two, and he thought that.
I don't have a problem with delegating. We didn't have to delegate a lot of stuff, you know, because we kept it pretty contained.
When you were shooting, the script was finished by the time you started first day of shooting, so you didn't have to worry about what's the ending gonna be or what the rewrites were.
The
Okay.
script was completely finished. It might be the first time I've ever had that experience, but usually, you know, you're Well, in some cases, like in Jurassic Park 3, we never did have an ending. You know, the joke was that the script was going to be a crew gift at the end of the shoot. But you know, it was. I mean, we tweaked it along the way, as you always do. You know, ideas come up, and you know, lines of dialogue and stuff like that, and occasionally actors will do some improv here and there, which is great, as long as we have what was on the page, you know. But yeah, it was complete and fully functional.
I have a fundamental question for you, and simplistic maybe, but I'm wondering if this was a fun, satisfying, good job for you, because you've hinted that other things you've done maybe weren't so fun and satisfying and good. But did you enjoy this?
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it a lot, mostly because of the support that I had. You know, I had a team behind me that was doing everything they possibly could to make the best film. You know, Kevin and Stephen Broussard and his their team. I'm forgetting names now.
Victoria Alonso.
Victoria, I'm forgetting other names. It's been a long time. I haven't, you know, I haven't seen the movie since right after it came out. So, I was thinking, oh, I should watch the movie again if I'm going to talk to you guys, and I just haven't had any time to do it. So, sorry about that.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. We'll watch it for you. Don't worry.
Yes.
I also have to ask, after you did this gigantic film, the movie following this was not safe for work. The movie title was not safe for work, which is kind of a more, which is difficult to, we've all agreed it's difficult to Google.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that seemed to be a much more compact and workaday film. Was that kind of as taking a break from after this
Well,
massive?
I really just wanted to see if I could do it. You know, the total budget was, I think, 2.5 million and a 20-day shoot. I mean, we had no money for anything. And I thought this would be an interesting exercise. I mean, the Blumhouse films, they have sort of a style. I mean, the found footage movies work great. This sort of standard narratives one like Not Safe for Work are a little bit tougher because you're trying to make a movie without set found footage, you know, and you're trying to do it in 20 days, and it's almost like shooting a TV episode in a way. But it was a good experience, you know, it was a lot of fun. Good crew, good cast. It was And it didn't last. It didn't take up a whole lot of my time.
Joe, one of the most recent directorial works of yours that I saw was Inside the Magic, which was a 3-episode run on Disney Plus, and just absolutely fantastic. And at times quite moving, quite touching look back at the history of ILM. And one of the things that I thought was so great about that, and I was talking with Jim and Brian about this before you came on, was the idea that you know, you're the director and you're sort of the unseen and unheard interviewer, as is traditional in something like that. But then as it goes on, people are starting to say, "Hi, Joe," and talking to you a little bit, and that made it so much more relatable and intimate. Did that just happen organically, or was that a specific choice you made?
You know, I never told anybody, yes, say hi when you come in, you know, but it just sort of happened. And I had originally said, I don't want my voice or face on the screen at all. But, you know, the editors who were working separately from, you know, when I was doing interviews and shooting stuff, they sort of had their own plan, and they were putting together what they thought was, you know, the right version of the series. I thought it worked out pretty well. That whole thing at the end, where the sort of goodbye to ILM, you know, closing the ILM Kerner thing, none of that was intended to be in either. But I think it worked out really well with, especially with John Knoll, you know, saying,
Oh, yeah.
and his speech at the end was great. It was, I talked to John a couple of times while we were shooting the series. I said, you know, John, this is sort of the John Knoll story. I think it scared him a little bit, you know.
Well, it was great to see it. He's got such a remarkable story, you know, with Lucasfilm and story work on Rogue One, and then, you know, by the way, he and his brother inventing Photoshop along the way. We had him out here in Oshkosh for a screening of Rogue One. He and I did together, and that was a thrill.
Great.
I do have a question about when you're first approaching this and you were looking at, you know, doing the transformation of Steve Rogers into Captain America. Was that quickly thought out, or how you were going to do Skinny Steve, or?
Well, it was we knew it was going to be a process involving a lot of visual effects and multiple takes on things. I don't think we quite knew how difficult it was going to be before we started. We had to shoot the scene with Chris Evans as Chris Evans because we wanted to sort of establish his performance. And then we had to shoot the scene without him in it, with the other actors, reacting as if he was there. And then we had to shoot the scene with a body double who was the size we wanted him to become. And then we had to shoot some blue screen stuff of if anybody was passing in front of him or he was, passing in front of somebody else, we had to shoot blue screen pieces of it. So it became this hugely complicated thing that I don't think we really knew what it was going to be when we started. We knew that what the process was going to be. And we knew this company in LA called Lola was going to be able to take his, the fully buffed up Chris Evans and reduce him down to this, 90-pound weakling. We knew that the process was going to be. We just didn't know what we had to do to get there. And thank God it's only the part of the first act.
Yeah, you're out of it by like minute 35, so
Yeah, I mean there was a lot of stuff, but it was just this amazing series of things we had to do, and we didn't really realize we didn't sit down and plot every piece of this because we would be shooting it, and then we'd say, oh yeah, he's going to go behind this guy, so we have to shoot a blue screen element of him. So it sort of snowballed along the way.
The results are staggering,
It worked great. It really worked great.
and 15 years on, it's hard to believe it's been that long. It looks every bit as good today. I mean, you simply can't tell. You just believe it. It's
There was one scene, I think it's where Stanley Tucci is handing him the schnapps. They're sitting there on the cots talking, and that one was really tricky because he had to take the glass from him, and then Stanley Tucci had to take it back. And I forget what we had to do, but we were on that one moment for hours trying to figure out how to do it,
Wow.
but it all worked out eventually.
Yeah, and the body double wound up being the bartender in London, so he might
Right,
have it.
he did. Remind me of his name now.
Oh dear. I
Sorry.
think Brian has IMDb open, so he might
I
be able to.
No, I
No,
closed it.
okay.
Sorry. Go
That's all right.
buddy.
Well,
We
hopefully
didn't know there
we'll
was going to be a test.
yeah,
Yeah.
we'll insert we'll insert his name in somewhere. Well, actually, hopefully I've sent in a message to his agent, so hopefully he'll be on our show.
Good. Yeah, I'm sure he will. He's a very nice guy.
Yeah, and it
Very
doesn't sound
patient.
like it. Yeah, it doesn't sound like it'll be an easy thing to sit through. And it's like no, move a little bit to the left, move to the right, and then wait for.
Oh, he had to pretty much copy what Chris had done, but he's copying it, in a 5/6 scale. So it was tricky. And we also ha he had to wear little antennae on his head because,
Where his head would be, yeah.
that's where you need to look. You
Oh.
need to look at his eyes up here, and his fellow actors would usually forget to look at him, which means you're looking at Chris Evans' throat, so
I would think that'd be such a hard thing to do. And in later movies, you see the behind the scenes stuff where you're dealing with characters like the Hulk and Thanos, who are like 9.5 feet tall, and they've got these big backpack rigs of Thanos's head floating above them. I can't imagine acting in that situation.
I know.
And I would like to offer a sincere apology to Leander Deeney. That was his name.
Leander, that's
There we go.
it.
Yes. But hopefully, if you'll forgive us, Leander, please be on our show in a
Yes,
later
hopefully
episode. We would
we can
appreciate it.
apologize in person.
Yes, I hope he'll agree to do that. He's a nice guy.
Well, Joe, again, thanks again for letting us do yet another one of your movies. We are, as you know, big fans, and it's always great being able to talk about your shows because it's we really enjoy them so much, and it's not often that we get to thank people that made us happy.
I just got to find one more, guys. One more. That's all.
Okay. Yeah.
One more. Are we still?
There's this thing about a group of podcasters who get really into analyzing movies. Look, give me 30 seconds, Joe.
It's a
big elephant.
It's a
Hal's been working on
Mertens, right?
yeah yeah Hal's been working on this elevator pitch for years. Mild-mannered guy who runs a flight school up in Wisconsin. Thanks, Joe, for being on our opening episode with many more to come. But
always a pleasure.
Thanks to our audience for joining us. If you'd like to continue this conversation that we just started, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.